Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Manual Therapy blog in our interview series. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Mike Baum. Mike is a physical therapist that lives in Junction City, Oregon. He is also a business owner, a clinic owner of Oregon Neurosport Physical Therapy in the same city, Junction City, Oregon. And Mike has an interesting background. He has a lot of influence from many different realms of physical therapy and manual therapy education. But one of the most interesting things about Mike is how he has been trained in proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation, PNF. Mike got to spend time in their residency program at Kaiser Vallejo, and subsequently after that, got to spend 4 or 5 years as a clinician at Kaiser Vallejo, as well as primary faculty for their residency program. So he's also been not only teaching at Kaiser Vallejo during that time, but he's also been teaching PNF around the country with the Institute of Physical Art since about 1994. So he's definitely well-versed in this treatment intervention called PNF, which really, when you look at some things in research, it's a lot about stretching, you know, hold, relax, stretching, contract, relax, stretching, especially when you start to get outside of physical therapy and you start to look at sports-related things or athletic training things. They really focus on the stretching side, which if that's all you hear about or if that's all you read or if that's all you've learned, you're really missing the boat. It's a wonderful treatment system and treatment paradigm. And if you listen in on this interview, you'll understand why, as Mike really delves into how his practice incorporates that extremely well, in addition to many different types of manual therapy approaches. And he's got a lot of nuggets of clinical wisdom in this as it relates to that. So if you're interested in PNF and you've learned some of it, then great. You know, you can really get a sense of how somebody who's a master at it can maybe help your practice. If you're not interested in it and you haven't really given much thought about it, or if you've had some exposure to it in, say, grad school but never really got impressed by it or really saw the benefit of it, listen in too, because you're really going to see how this can be incorporated into an entire treatment paradigm and not just used on patients with neurological problems. This really runs the gamut for anybody who walks in your door can benefit from this treatment approach. Now, admittedly, this is not the only reason for our interview with Mike. Like I said, Mike is a practice owner. He teaches. He's a very good therapist, and he gets great results. So other things beyond just PNF that you'll learn from this interview that can help inspire you, educate you, and maybe empower you to change a little bit about how you practice in the clinic as well. So listen up. Stay tuned in for this interview. It's quite a pleasure to get to speak with Mike. I have the benefit, and hopefully he doesn't mind me saying the fortune of having him as a friend and colleague, not just an acquaintance or somebody that I get to interview. So if you have any thoughts or questions, please include them below. I certainly enjoyed doing this interview, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. Hey everyone, this is Matt. Again, we're doing another interview today, and today we're speaking with Mike Baum. He's a physical therapist out of Junction City, Oregon. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks Matt for having me here.
Yeah, Mike, can you start off like we always do, just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I started off going to physical therapy school at Northeastern University, thinking that I was going to do sports med. And we had a cooperative education program, and I was very, very fortunate to work with a fellow named Joel Rosenstein, who had been the head trainer for the New York Cosmos. And so I worked with him while I was going to school at Northeastern. I was working for him as an aide, and he was actually showing me quite a few things. I got to work with quite a few professional athletes. We got to work with Elaine Zak, who was then the world figure skating champion prior to the 84 Olympics. We got to work with some of the New York Rangers, some of the New York Knicks, and I really thought I wanted to do sports med. And my second to last affiliation was at Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation.
Oh, yeah.
And they were known later on for where Christopher Reeve had gone. I was there prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a job there when I graduated because I was intrigued with neurological rehabilitation. I'd never really done spinal cord or stroke before, and you really had to think on your feet. And I'd been there 3 years. I'd worked at both the Saddlebrook and West Orange facility. And two of the young ladies that I was working with went to do a postgraduate residency at Kaiser Vallejo to learn PNF. And they came back and they were doing absolutely amazing things with the patients. And I said, "Where'd you go?" And they said, "Vallejo, California." And I'm from New York and was living in Jersey and had no idea where Vallejo, California was, but I figured I better sign up for it. And I did, and there was a 1-year waiting list. Wow. And so in the meantime, I saw a little advertisement that said study in China. So I had some vacation time saved up, and I went to China. And we spent some time at the Olympic Training Center. I was there for most of the month of April of 1989. And when I came back, I resigned from my position, became a traveling physical therapist, feeling that I should probably see the country before I go to Vallejo, California and commit. And I ended up in the desert in California, in Blythe. I ended up in Pueblo, Colorado, and then I ended up in Sitka, Alaska, where I met my wife.
Wow.
And I went from Sitka to Vallejo, California, and I was at the PNF program for a few weeks, and they had a job opening, and they offered me a position, and I asked my soon-to-be wife, "What do you think about California?" And she said, "Let's give it a try." And so I accepted the position, finished the 3-month program, went on staff, continued training. They let me continue training with Sue Adler, and I began teaching there a little bit after. And the majority of therapists over there also had very good manual therapy skills, and I had taken a bunch of weekend seminars and weekend courses when I was living in New Jersey, and I got to meet some just outstanding people. I got to take a class from Dr. Minnell. I got to take a class from Vernon Brooks. Just some amazing people, Sandy Burkhardt, a lot of good people. And I wanted to learn more about manual therapy in addition to PNF, so I did 2-year-long programs. One was 1 time a week for a year, and the other was 1 weekend a month for a year. They were both Australian Maitland-based. I really enjoyed the heck out of that. And so I was teaching at Vallejo, and I was also helping Sue Adler when she was teaching at UCSF. We both volunteered for that. And I was feeling pretty comfortable with things till I helped Sue Adler teach a class, and she blew me away. She was just so unbelievably efficient with her treatment on a head injured patient and then also on one of my incomplete spinal cord patients that I continued staying on in Vallejo and really just enjoyed the heck out of it. But it was getting a little rough as far as the type of patients we were seeing. We were seeing a lot more gang-related gunshot injuries, and my wife thought it was time to move. So in the meantime, I've been working weekends both through San Francisco and also Oakland, and a company that I had been doing weekend work with heard that I was moving. I told them I'm going to be leaving the Bay Area, and they had a position in Eugene, Oregon for facility rehab director.
Wow.
And not knowing nothing about Eugene, Oregon, but wanting to be in the Pacific Northwest near my wife's family, we interviewed there, and I took the job, became a facility rehab director, and ended up turning a skilled nursing facility wing into a subacute center for orthopedic and neurologically involved patients. And I did that for about 2 years. When they kind of went in-house, because I was working for a corporation, I went back up to Alaska for a year with my wife, and I was teaching a class in Oregon for the state conference. It was 97, and I was offered a job by McKenzie Willamette Hospital. Came down here, and I ended up working with Kent Kaiser, who was a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And when our hospital was bought out by a larger hospital. They closed the small clinic that I was at in Junction City, and we opened up our own clinic, and that was 13 years ago. So in a nutshell, that's pretty much my story, and I've been working with the IPA in the meantime since 1994. I began teaching with them, took my first course with them in 93, and really enjoyed the heck out of both Greg and Vicky Johnson. Very inspirational to me. Kent Kaiser, also very inspirational to me, learned a ton. And also just taking a lot of different continuing education courses from a lot of very, very good people. Earl Pettman, Cliff Fowler, my friend Bill Temis, just a lot of good people out there. A lot of good people shared a lot of things. I got to take a couple of classes recently with Lori Hartman, Dr. Hartman, who you were instrumental in setting one up a few years ago, and then took another one this past April. And I try to keep as many Con Ed classes as I can under my belt because there's always something to learn.
Yeah, definitely. So I have a few follow-up questions just from some of the stuff you were mentioning. The first one is, and listeners might be able to pick up a little bit of an accent. You said you're from New York, but what part of New York?
Well, originally, as a child, I was in New York City, Upper East Side, in Washington Heights, and then my parents moved us out to a town called Spring Valley. And so I ended up growing up in Spring Valley, New York.
Okay. So is that on Long Island or upstate or what?
No, it's in Rockland County on the New Jersey side.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So and you went to college at Northeastern?
Northeastern in Boston, Massachusetts, right. And I was there from 81 to 86. It was a 5-year program.
Oh, wow. Okay. So one of the things that I do remember learning about you, Mike, is that you used to be a pretty good martial artist as well, right?
Well, I got beat up by some really, really good people. How's that sound? But I used to fight knockdown karate, Kyokushin karate, and I did that in kind of the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, and I did quite well with that, but I did get banged up a little bit. But it was a wonderful way to meet other people because when I was a traveling therapist, I got to meet some great martial artists in Southern California, Las Vegas, Nevada. And when I was in the Bay Area, I got to meet some tremendous martial artists, doing Kaja Kembo. And since I've been out here, we have some friends of ours who I treat and we sometimes work out with who have also been amazing martial artists. I got to train and work out with Boss Rutten, who was the UFC heavyweight champ when he came up here to Junction City. A friend of mine used to teach for him. So I've had wonderful experiences in the martial arts, just connecting me with other people. And it's very amazing how when we look at physical therapy and efficiency of movement and you look at good martial artists, you see quite a few similarities. We had some very, very good judo people out in the Eugene area. A friend of mine's son, who used to throw me around, ended up going to the Olympics and taking 9th in the world. His name was Rick Hahn. And he was also fighting. So there's quite a few similarities between efficiency and movement, martial arts, and then what you see with dysfunction, where people compensate in order to get the job done. So we noticed a lot of similarities.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you. Do you think that's really helped you out in terms of your professional life and how you either see things or treat people?
I would say absolutely, 100% yes. One is it really helps me with my body mechanics on how to assist people in making themselves more efficient with manual therapy and with PNF, which is an integral part of my practice. The other thing is it lets me understand when people are efficient and inefficient, and it's also given me confidence to deal with pretty much anybody. I feel comfortable dealing with anybody across any spectrum, whether it's somebody who is a victim of gang-related gunshot injury, gang-related violence, or it's someone who has an industrial injury, or a 5-year-old child with cerebral palsy, or a geriatric with a stroke, or a younger person with a head injury, or somebody with a back injury.
Yeah. All right. That's great, because it's nice to hear how different therapists get influenced by, you know, things in their background. What got you interested in being a physical therapist, Mike?
Well, it gets back to back to martial arts. We used to work out in a full contact system. We used to get pretty beat up. And I used to wrestle also, and I had hurt myself. And one of my coaches and one of my instructors said, hey, go get manipulated. You'll feel better. And I went to a chiropractor, and I like chiropractics. There's nothing wrong with it, but it didn't help. And my back was still hurting. I was still having problems fighting, and I was still having problems wrestling. And so I went to go see a therapist, and it helped. And I said, well, what are you doing? And they said, well, we're doing some physical therapy and showing you how to strengthen yourself and stretch and still doing some manual therapy. And I said, this would be a great thing to learn not only how to defend yourself and you know, have full contact fights with other people, but also to be able to help them recoup after the damage is done.
Yeah, that's a good point. After you knock them down, you just toss your business card as you're walking away.
You know, I think it was more me getting knocked down and figuring out how to fix myself up too. We had some wonderful, wonderful people I used to work out with, and they were very good.
Cool. So you mentioned earlier getting started at Kessler and yes. How that was a big influence. And from there, a couple of therapists who came back from Vallejo and getting to see kind of the really magical things that they were doing at the time. Were there any other people in your life, especially earlier on in your career, that influenced you getting into manual therapy? Because you mentioned Sue Adler. I mean, if you can, you know, talk about her a little bit more, that'd be great.
Sure. So Sue Adler was just, and she still is, she's an amazing physical therapist. When I was working at Vallejo, I want to say this with all respect, Sue was really the matriarch of PNF, absolutely unbelievable. And she would come and work with us once a week and really show us a lot of the nuances. And to watch her treat was absolutely incredible. Mm. I used to treat her husband for some things, and which kind of endeared me to her slightly.
Yeah.
And I've actually just seen her do just some such amazing work with people that she really really got me going and said, you know, there's no limit to what you can do. Greg Johnson also, I had met Greg and Vicky Johnson when we were actually teaching at the Maggie Knott Symposium and I was presenting. And then also when Dr. Herman Cabot, who was the originator of PNF, came to present at the first International PNF Association meeting in 1993. And he had stayed afterward. Nobody had even known where he'd been. He was about 81, 82 years old.
Wow.
And he actually came and stayed for another 6 months. And I had the great honor and privilege to work with him, and which was really wonderful.
Wow.
While I was at Vallejo, one of the people who I was a preceptor for, who was absolutely incredible, was a woman named Dee Lily Matsuda, who is now Dee Lily. And she's probably about 85 now. And she'd actually been the PT instructor in physical therapy school for quite a few people who were teaching the Vallejo program, as well as Kent Kaiser. She was actually his instructor in PT school.
Oh,
he
wow.
was in one of her first classes. And she was absolutely incredible, and PhD in neurophysiology and neuroanatomy. Very, very inspiring person. And even though I was helping her with PNF, she was helping me understand quite a few things. So, you know, absolutely incredible people. Everybody there was absolutely tremendous, and everybody gave me kind of a lot of incentive to continue improving. When I had taken a year-long manual therapy class, one of the people who really broke me out of the box was a guy named Wayne Diamond, who had spent a lot of time in Australia. Also a guy named Bob Nee, who's actually up here in Oregon. He's in Portland now. He's a professor over at Pacific University up in Forest Grove in the physical therapy school. And so there's a lot of inspiring people, a lot of really amazing talent out there. Tim Johnston, who runs the program at Vallejo now, Chris Pappas were wonderful mentors with me, and just really showed me that there's no limit with what you can do.
Yeah. Well, before we get too much further into this, Mike, a lot of good mention of PNF and Kaiser Vallejo for any listeners out there who, you know, aren't as familiar with what PNF is and either the Kaiser Vallejo program. You know, everybody gets a little bit of PNF in grad school. Can you describe to us what it is in your words and kind of, I mean, you were an instructor for many years in it, and you still are actually an instructor in PNF. So can you talk to us a little bit about what that is?
Sure, absolutely. So PNF stands for proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation. And it is a philosophy of both evaluation and treatment that was developed in the mid-1940s by Dr. Herman Cabot, who is both a physician and a neurophysiologist, and was really implemented by his physical therapist named Maggie Knott. And we had asked Dr. Cabot how he actually came up with this. And the story that he told us, and it was a great story, was that he had gone to a seminar given by Sister Kenny out in Minnesota.
Elizabeth Kenny.
Who was Sister Kenny, right. And they actually have a Sister Kenny Rehabilitation Institute out in Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Yep. And she was treating polio patients, and she was the first one to start getting very good results with them by doing exercise. And he had let us know that he approached her and says, this is wonderful stuff, but why are you doing things in straight plane movements, linear movements, when people move in spirals and diagonals? There's muscular skeletal attachments from origin to insertion in spiral and diagonal components. And she said to him, if you think you can do it better, why don't you figure it out yourself? And he said, okay. And he started looking at efficient movements. Huh. And he started looking at athletes and dancers and what people had in common. And he was looking at efficiency of movement and came up with some basic principles and also utilized a lot of Sherrington's works on neurophysiology and came up with basic principles about PNF and then PNF patterns, which are specific diagonal patterns where people are most efficient. You present with those patterns with being inherently stronger, better irradiation or purposeful spreading of response from strong to weak, and better utilization of quick stretch reflex. And what you find is that you can use PNF not only for treatment, but also for evaluative technique. You can superimpose it on any type of manual therapy philosophy that you're already doing. You can use it to assist with any type of manipulation, mobilization, and neuromuscular education after those techniques. You can use it for tone inhibition. You can use it for facilitation. It's absolutely wonderful, wonderful philosophy and technique. And I try to be very eclectic, utilizing functional mobilization and any type of manipulation that I can learn, manual therapy that I could learn, any type of new technique, retraining the brain, things that Butler and Mosley talk about. But what you find is when you superimpose PNF on top of it, it's much more efficient treatment and you get amazing results. And you can also find some things you can figure out when you don't get what's expected and sometimes get to the root of what the problem is versus just treating the symptom.
So for the one of the big things in research now about, you know, chronic nonspecific lower back pain and outcomes with that, and should we be doing this or should we be doing that? You know, somebody walks in your door that's middle-aged and they have a long history of a nonspecific back pain. Are you just laying them down and starting to check pelvic patterns on them, or?
Well, the first thing that we check is basic scan exam. You know, the most important thing to find out is to make sure that if somebody comes in with nonspecific pain, is it mechanical in nature? Is it a mechanical problem, a motor control issue? Is there a possible organic or non-organic sign or symptom? You know, the worst thing in the world is to have somebody come in with generalized nonspecific back pain. You don't do a good enough history and it turns out it's metastatic cancer from an old cancerous problem they had they thought was resolved, and now it turns out they have Mets. So that, unfortunately, we've picked that up in a few people where it was not mechanical or neuromuscular in nature, and we sent them back to the physician. Further objective tests were done, and unfortunately, it turned out it was a non-mechanical problem. Now, on the other hand, there's many people who come in, and we do a full scan on everybody, you know, range of motion, overpressure, manual muscle testing, looking for fatigability for potential radiculopathy versus just referred pain, making sure that we've checked their SI joint, making sure we've checked some visceral stuff. And you know, again, myotomes, dermatomes, DTRs, all those things, vertical compression test, core stabilization, utilizing what Greg and Vicky Johnson have came up with called a lumbar protective mechanism test, elbow flexion test. And then when we check everything, we look at their efficiency of spreading of response. I can do a PNF lower extremity pattern and see if I'm getting translation up into the cervical area. I can resist their lower extremities in a hook lying position and see if I get short cervical neck flexion kicking in. If I don't, I know that someplace along the kinetic chain, there's a dysfunction. I can do pelvic or scapular patterns and see where I'm not getting efficiency of movement or efficiency of spreading of motor response, which is very nice. Then I go back in, check my PIVMs, do my stress tests, see what's going on. Now, the beauty of PNF is that there's quite a few people who may not do well with manipulation. And these are the people who have already been to other therapists, chiropractors, osteopaths. They've already been manipulated. They say, great, it feels good for 2 to 3 days. Then it comes back again. Is there anything you can do to help? And the answer is yes, there is. Because if you can even get a little bit of response, then I know I can help you. And, you know, working the pelvic patterns, scapular patterns, neuromuscular education, combining it with functional mobilization, combining it with facilitation of core stabilizers, you know, again, utilizing what they can do to help what they can't do seems to work very, very well, because we have a lot of people who I'm their fourth or fifth therapist, and they go, okay, I've heard about you. Tell me what you can do, because I'm not really getting any better, and I don't want to have repeated corticosteroid injections, epidural injections, or potential fusions. What can you do?
Yeah.
And we find combining PNF neuromuscular reeducation, motor control with manual therapy, including functional mobilization, joint mobilization, manipulation if appropriate, or functional manipulation, we have really good results. And we seem to get great carryover, and we seem to be able to get people independent with a good home program. And again, utilizing the PNF patterns for the home program really seems to help get good carryover.
So as a home program, or even if somebody, you know, you're done working with them doing your manual or neuromuscular mm-hmm. treatments in the clinic,
mm-hmm.
do you have them going through patterns at home, or do you have them go through patterns in the clinic to continue exercising? And are you just using TheraBand for resistance, or do you have no resistance? Kind of how do you follow up with that?
Well, I usually follow up with it by looking at where I can get the greatest bang for my buck, meaning I only want to give them two or three exercises at one time, otherwise they become overwhelmed.
Right.
So I tend to use what's strong to help what's weak. So with the PNF philosophy, we try to use what's most functional to facilitate what's dysfunctional. So if they have a problem bringing in lower abdominals, lower middle, you know, if they have a problem with bringing in core, levator ani, pubococcygeal, pelvic floor, transversus abdominis, multifidi, and I can't get them to do it with the traditional ways, you know, pull in your pelvic floor, you know, get skinny, put a sphygmomanometer or a blood pressure type cuff under their back to get them to stabilize, I'll go with upper extremity chopping, because mm-hmm. I know that the core musculature, according to Dr. Hodges, who I greatly respect and have taken a few classes with, it should come in automatically. So when we look at PNF, we also look at developmental sequence. And if I can kick in upper trunk, short neck flexors, I can kick in lower trunk and core, and I get great results. So I may have the person do a developmental activity of resisted rolling, utilizing upper extremity chopping with resisted TheraBand on their bed or the floor. Mm. Or in a sitting position, have them use TheraBand or TheraTube doing a chop. Or I may have them do a modified bridge with their lower extremities on a ball or a roller, while concurrently they're stabilizing a resisted band and doing an upper extremity lifting pattern. Mm. So we try to put things together and try to make it functional, but to do it in a safe environment so that if it does start to aggravate or exacerbate signs and symptoms, they could stop right away before there's any significant damage done.
Cool. That's great to hear. I love hearing that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, how you met several different people and,
mm-hmm.
To kind of change subjects a little bit, you also mentioned how you got to Oregon and,
yes.
and even Junction City specifically.
Yes.
And then you said the place that you worked at got bought out or closed out and you guys opened your own clinic.
Correct. Correct.
How?
I had been working for Mackenzie Willamette Hospital, which is a wonderful community-based hospital in Springfield, Oregon, which is
yeah.
just adjacent to Eugene, Oregon, where
yeah.
Peace Health is. And Mackenzie Willamette had actually been bought out by a company called Triad, and they were a large hospital system based out of Texas. And they actually closed down the Junction City Clinic. So I live outside of Junction City, about 10 miles west, so I live in a very, very rural community. Junction City itself is a very small town. There's about 5,000 people. And it's known for RV manufacturing. They had a big RV plant, Country Coach. The next town over, Harrisburg, had Safari. Very small town, wonderful people. Next town near there is Monroe, Oregon, very small farming community. The farmers out here primarily grow grass seed, hay, filbert, and Christmas trees. So it's a very rural area. And when the clinic closed down, my wife said, look, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't want to drive 35 minutes to work at the hospital because we have children. I'd rather just stay local. And so we opened up our own clinic. We had a few doctors in town who I knew very well. And I said, "Hey, do you have any problem with me opening a clinic? Is there, any questions you have?" They said, "We'd love to support you." And I was also getting referrals from both Eugene and some from Corvallis. And because of my teaching with the Institute of Physical Art, I started getting some referrals from Portland, Oregon. I got some referrals from Chico, California, where you are right now. I've been out there teaching a few times. I actually had some patients come from Chico for me to treat out here. It was very interesting because, and again, I get back to the IPA. It's opened up a lot of doors. I was teaching a class in Fremont, California, and one of the students asked if I'd like to go to Japan. And I thought she was joking. And 2 years later, there I was in Japan teaching a class at Niigata University.
Wow.
And then last year, 2016, we actually taught a class in Lugo, Spain. I was invited to go to Lugo, Spain. We were a trip to Spain, and we had a student who had been from Spain, and we just said, "Hey, we'd love to come see you, your family." And we started talking, and the next thing you know, turned out her dad had a friend who was a therapist in Lugo. So we went from Barcelona to Madrid, all the way out to the West Coast, ended up in Lugo, and we had a wonderful time out there. The people were unbelievably cordial and inviting to us, and we had a great class with about 32 people doing PNF and just introducing them to functional manual therapy. It was absolutely terrific.
Wow, that's
So
awesome.
yeah, we had some nice times going international.
Well, Mike, that's just a testament to the type of guy you are and the type of instructor you are.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm very humbled though, because what I'll honestly tell you is that I could not share this information unless I had been basically mentored by some of the greats. And I got to tell you, I've been unbelievably privileged to have trained and learned from some of the better people, I think, in our profession. And I'm still learning from the wonderful people. So, every time I think I know what I'm doing, a patient comes in, I go, let's see. I don't know what to do. Let's see if we can figure things out. And then we get back to PNF and we go, "Wait a second. I know you're having this diagnosis of knee pain, and I know your lumbar range of motion is terrific, and I know that you're not really presenting with any back pain, but holy smokes, your orthopedic surgeon's one of the best in the business. We can't figure out anything. MRI was done. Let's go take a look at spreading response. It looks like you have some back stuff going on. Let's take a look at this, and this. Looks like you have some SI joint stuff going on. And we treat the person as a whole, and all of a sudden we see improvement in their knee, which what we thought was knee might have been a little bit of an L4 radiculopathy, although it was not presenting classically. It was presenting more like a zebra than a horse. And we had two of those people this week, which was very interesting. So yeah, very, very interesting. Or the person who comes in, where we've been very, very fortunate, had a young lady who had severe vertigo. She'd been hit by a car, had three blood clots in her brain that they didn't figure out for 6 months until someone at the hospital tried an epley maneuver and she passed out. And they said, "We better do another CT scan," and found three blood clots.
Oh my gosh.
And nobody could get rid of her dizziness. And we kind of took a look at her upper C spine and said, "You got some upper C spine problems, but you're on Coumadin because where the blood clots were and had been so long, they decided not to do surgery and see if they could put her on anticoagulants." And so she's absolutely not a candidate for any vigorous manual therapy. But what we found was that we could do PNF scapula patterns, stabilize her at C1, and make tremendous changes, and got rid of probably about 60% of her vertigo.
Wow.
So we're very, very, very fortunate in that. And the nice part about being eclectic and doing functional manual therapy and PNF is that you have more tools in your toolbox. And if somebody doesn't fit in to a traditional presentation, you can figure things out, which is really nice. And the nice part about that is I think I really started improving on that when I was treating more and more neurologically involved patients, because you start getting different spinal cord patients, especially people who've been shot, and it doesn't follow traditional patterns. You have somebody with a gunshot injury, entrance at C6-7, exit at T8, who presents like a brown Sequard, who's basically a quadriplegic with sensory in one arm and no motor, and then motor in one arm and no sensory. You better figure things out. So the neuro rehab really, really helped with that. And we still treat neuro rehab and even some pediatrics. I had a couple of pediatrics, 2 5-year-old little girls with cerebral palsy that we were able to have some fun with and help with their gait, and also look at mechanical things, which was nice.
Wow. Some of the questions that I continue to ask in each interview, I feel like I have to ask, even though you kind of already answered it, but we'll see if you have anything else to add to it. As long as you've been a physical therapist at this time and all the different things that you've gotten to learn and see, what still gets you excited, when you go to work or, treating patients in the clinic?
Well, I'll tell you, I get excited every day. And I'm going to back up to one of my mentors, Stu Adler.
Yes.
So I'm pushing 54 now, and I've been doing this because, again, when I came out of school, it was still a bachelor's. So I came out of school, I was a little bit before my 23rd birthday. So I was a PT at 22, short of my 23rd birthday. And when I was at Vallejo, I was there from 90 to 94. So April of 90 to July, August of 94. And so Sue, who at that time had been in her early 60s, and I was in my late 20s, approaching 30, right? Actually, I left, I was about 31 years old. And I said to her, so Sue, when are you going to stop being a therapist? And she goes, when it's not fun anymore. And I said, no, that's the best piece of advice that I've ever been given. So what pumps me up is every day I come to work, I see somebody presenting with something new, and that I have hopefully the tools to not necessarily cure them, but improve the quality of their life. Whether it's somebody presenting with back pain, somebody presenting with neck pain, somebody presenting with extremity problems, or somebody presenting with neurological problems, or both. Today I had a wonderful lady that I hadn't seen in about 4 years who has Parkinson's, neck pain, upper extremity pain, and the brain stimulator is not working anymore. So she came in with her daughter. And I said, what's going on? And she said, my arm is killing me. My neck is killing me. I'm having medial border scapula pain. Nobody could figure it out. And we took a good look at her, and we knew she had neck pain, but she also had some impingement. And she also had some mechanical problems in her left upper extremity. We worked on those, worked on some soft tissue, did some PNF neuromuscular reeducation, did some taping of her, showed her daughter how to do some pneumatic decompression. And she made significant improvement. And that was wonderful, because we got to help the quality of her life and have her less dependent on care because she's in less pain.
Yeah.
So, those type of things are fun. Same as the person who comes in who's an athlete and we got to get him going for the next game, or the person who comes in has to get back to work. So we're in a very nice situation here where, because I'm in a rural community, I get to see orthopedic and neurologically involved patients. So I get to use all my skills, not just some.
Yeah.
And again, what I'll tell you is I've never treated an orthopedically involved patient who does not have motor control issues. And I've never treated a neurologically involved patient who does not have some type of mechanical dysfunction. Because we're human beings. When somebody comes in, again, another example, had a wonderful young lady comes to see me. She's 13 years post-traumatic amputation. She's a BK amputation. And she was sent to see me because of ongoing phantom limb pain from a secondary surgery she had a year ago. And we kind of found out some of it's looking like it's coming from her lumbosacral area. And we worked on some retraining of homunculus, but we also found maybe there's a little neuroma at the end of her stump. Worked some manual therapy, neural tensioning, neural flossing, worked pelvic patterns, worked core stabilization, worked mobilization of iliopsoas, postural retraining, and her phantom pain almost disappeared. Now, I also use modalities such as TENS because I like using TENS for phantom pain. Had great results with it for a lot of different amputees I work with. And so we give her a TENS unit too and give her exercises to do too. But you find that when you're able to help people and improve the quality of their life, it makes me feel like I've done something to help someone else, and it gives you a good feeling.
Yeah. And Mike, you also get to train other physical therapists, right? In kind of a residency situation?
I do. So we are a residency site for the Institute of Physical Art, which is a wonderful organization that was developed by Greg and Vicki Johnson back in 1978. And they are absolutely tremendous people. Can't say enough for them. I'm also adjunct clinical faculty at University of Oregon for the master's degree program for the athletic trainers. So I've been doing that. I wasn't sure. I think it's been now 13 years, and it's been absolutely wonderful. I go down there every other year and give them some instruction in PNF for working with athletes. So that's just been absolutely a wonderful opportunity. And University of Oregon is just a great, great school, and I've been very blessed and fortunate to be able to be affiliated with them.
Cool. So you've been around educating other physical therapists and other students for quite a long time at this point. Given your interactions with those that you're teaching, whether they're in a residency situation or a weekend course or an ATC program, things like that, what are some things that you hope that those people learn from you or take away from their time with you that, you know, they carry on with the rest of their careers, whether it's professional or just personal?
Well, I would hope that for one thing, to always treat your patients as if they were family members, and always treat your patients in the same way you would like your family member to be treated by another healthcare practitioner. So if you can imagine your wife or your daughter or your son or your brother or your sister or your mother or father or grandparent being treated by a physical therapist, how would you like them to be treated? And please use that same courtesy and respect to treat each and every one of your patients, because treat as you would wish to be treated. The second thing is always think outside the box. Just because the patient's presenting with something that's not in the most recent research doesn't mean it doesn't exist, because we're finding many, many things about different patient presentations. People come in, they're not one-dimensional. People are multidimensional with their symptoms. There could be nutritional factors, there could be organic, inorganic, plus manual, musculoskeletal, mechanical, neuromuscular, so and neurological. So, take everything into consideration and always listen to your patient, because for the most part, your patient's there for you to help them. And if you've already made a diagnosis or an evaluative assumption on the patient before thoroughly listening to them and thoroughly evaluating them, you're going to miss really, really big things. And that may be what makes or breaks that patient. Again, you may be the person who picks up that cancerous tumor. You may be the person who picks up, oh boy, this is an organic problem. You better get checked. Oh, look, it turns out that some of your pain was kidney infection, kidney stones. Your problems may stem from diabetes. It was undiagnosed. You've never been to the doctor. We send you in. They do some blood work, do an A1C. It turns out you have type 1. I mean, things happen. Or just to listen to the patient, because you may also find out that there's a potentially unsafe situation going on, and you may be that person who first alerts law enforcement to a potential problem. And it's unfortunate, but in our society, that absolutely does happen. And so, it's important to both listen and observe everyone you work with and take what they say and then ask the same question from different angles, because that way you'll absolutely get the answer that may make or break your treatment. Because you may ask the person a question, they say, no problems. You ask them again a different way, they go, okay, yeah, that did happen. You ask them a third way, they go, I forgot to tell you that time I was ejected out of the windshield of my car, was in a coma for 3 weeks, which has actually been one of my patients who kind of forgot that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Have you ever had a trauma before? No.
Oh, yeah, we have that. And, interesting situations, because I used to volunteer as a firefighter out here too, and I became an EMT because we don't have a heck of a lot of fires. And once or twice I was on some calls and then later saw that same patient. And it was really interesting because I already knew exactly what happened. And asking the person questions, sometimes they leave out things and you kind of remind them of it and they kind of go, oh, I forgot all about that. How'd you know? I said, well, I was the medic on call who actually pulled you out of the car. So, yeah.
Wow. What a lot of what you just mentioned has to deal with questioning, gaining information from your interaction with the patient, and how much they can actually give you in terms of information. I think I'm going to butcher the phrase, but you know the adage that the patient will tell you what's wrong with them if you'll just get out of their way.
Absolutely, just listen. And then what you find is your hands will tell you even more.
Yeah.
Whatever they tell you, when you put your hands on them, you'll find out even more. And really just to refine your sense of touch. Something that my good friend Kent Kaiser has always told me is, you have different sensory nerve endings. You have them on your skin, you have them in your blood vessels, you have them in your bone. When you're palpate with your skin, palpate, feel what's going on. Don't push so hard that you've barged the barrier or gone through a restriction. You know, make sure you improve your palpation skills. Just because you don't feel it doesn't mean it's not there. Someone may come in with a different set of evaluative skills and find something that you didn't. And always be open to other people looking at things with a different point of view. And, you know, what I always tell my residents, what I always tell people that I'm mentoring or teaching is, we all have different skill sets. And when I'm working with a patient, it's not that I'm doing anything better or worse. I'm just doing it through a different set of glasses. I'm looking at what you did, and then I'm looking at what you didn't do, and let's try what you didn't do and see what we get. Because if somebody's not getting the appropriate improvement, it doesn't mean they can't get better. It just means we have to use a new set of tools and a new set of lenses to look at them. And that's what's always a lot of fun with PT is you end up being like a detective. I say like a detective because you can be like Sherlock Holmes. You can be like Miss Marple. You could be like whatever detective you want to be. But it's really fun problem solving and figuring out where the real problems are and making a change. And again, that's always a lot of fun when you're right on that one and can help someone.
Well, that's what's excited me in grad school about manual therapy and orthopedics and other things, is that it's not cookie cutter. Everything is different, and mm-hmm. you're exactly right. You got to figure out what is going on, so you're playing detective.
Yes.
Some of the other stuff that you just mentioned, I wanted to ask you about. So going back to gaining information from the patient,
mm-hmm.
how did you refine your skills with that? You know, whether it's conversing with a patient, knowing which questions to ask at the right time, is that something that you just learned from watching other people, or is that something you just learned the hard way over years of practice? Any ways to speak to that?
Sure, it's a lot of both. It's a lot of both. Sometimes you have to pick your mentors. Sometimes your mentors don't pick you. Sometimes you pick your mentors, whether you know it or not, by observing people who have different skills, watching how they do things and watching what works for them, how they succeed, and sometimes watching how they don't succeed and saying, okay, well, I'm looking at what they're doing that they're getting great results with. What are they doing that they aren't, and who's looking at things a different way, and how to basically look at what works and what doesn't, and also treating, I would tell you, hundreds if not thousands of patients. And a lot of it's from experience. And again, what I always tell people is, just when you think you know what you're doing, you find out you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Just when you think you know things, you find out you don't. I had a wake-up call when I was out of school for about 12 years. I thought I had a pretty good grasp on patient care. I'd done a bunch of postgraduate courses. I'd been at Vallejo, I'd been teaching, and I was working with my friend Kent Kaiser, and I was treating a patient, and I got him about 75% better. I said, Kent, come here, take a look, because we worked very closely together. And he said, did you check one thing? I said, oh, didn't check that, and he just went in and did one thing, and I said, oh, boy, I felt very humbled. And then I started taking more and more classes, and then I started feeling like I knew things, and then I started teaching with Greg Johnson. And then I felt humbled again. And then I started feeling like I knew what I was doing. And then taking more classes. And then took some classes with Ed Stiles, the osteopath. And then said, I kind of know this. And did some things with Dr. Hartman and said, boy, I feel humbled again. And a lot of times patients will come in and I will feel very humbled because I'll say, you know, I kind of see what's going on. And I missed that one. And it took me two visits instead of the first visit. And I should have picked it up. And let me look a little bit more at things. So a lot of it is finding a good mentor, taking a lot of classes, and just practice, practice, practice. And again, what I tell people who I mentor, because we have people who have been out of school 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 years, is that I've been doing this for 31 years, and I'm still learning every single day. And every single day, I'm getting another patient who is helping me to think outside the box. So I'm very grateful and very blessed for those patients and for the people I've gotten to learn from.
Yeah, that's
just keep practicing.
Yeah, that's one thing that is a little frustrating sometimes for me whenever I see other therapists in the clinic. And not that, you know, people don't have rough days where they don't want to think too much, but when you see somebody do the same thing over and over and over again with the patient, almost repeating the same treatment day after day that the patient is coming in, and they're not progressing, you know, they're not meeting the goals that they want. And being able to, like you say, think outside the box is something that's, to me, critical.
I would agree. I
Yeah.
would agree. And I know you yourself have had some wonderful mentors, so
Oh.
it's good to what's the old saying? I'm where I am because I stand on the backs of giants, right?
Yeah,
So
if I
there's
can
been just
see
some
further, it's
wonderful
because I've
people.
stood on the shoulders of giants.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting how many people are out there who can show you things.
Yeah.
And what we also tell people is please don't get stuck on what the MRI was, because the MRI may be wrong, and now you're pigeonholed as being somebody who is a malingerer, and it doesn't mean you're a malingerer. It means the MRI may be misinterpreted, or you may have had an MRI where you needed a contrast MRI. And we've had plenty of people who things don't show up on the objective tests, and the surgeon will go in there and go, "Oh, that was much worse than we thought, and we're really glad your therapist really pushed you to continue seeking help."
Wow.
So we've had some interesting cases.
Well, going back just and one more time, Mike, you were mentioning earlier also about touch and refining your skills with touch and sensitivity at palpation. And you had some great advice from one of our mutual friends, Kent Kaiser. Is there anything that you've also learned over the years that you think you could have done differently over time that could have helped you improve your sense of touch earlier on in your career?
Absolutely. A lot of it is not going in quite so aggressive initially. I started out as a student in sports medicine background, where back, I started doing sports med as a student back in 1982, and it was kind of the no pain, no gain era, where you just pushed them through and let's go get it done. And what you find is that if you lighten up your hands and you can feel where the dysfunction is. It will skin, superficial fascia, bony contours. You can feel increased tone. You can feel increased hypertonicity, potentially at areas of joint dysfunction. And you may be even picking up some abnormal tone where other people may not. And these are interesting things, because you may be the person who, because you've lightened up your sense of touch and looked at some basic things like checking for clonus, Babinski, and Hoffman test, especially clonus. You may be the guy picking out the myelopathy, where somebody has a centrally herniated disc, and it might be a cervical disc herniation, and you just ask the right questions to get it in there, check things out, and you go, "Boy, this is a big problem." Or you may be the person going in there and going, "Something's not right. I'm being too vigorous. Let me lighten up." There's quite a bit of increased tone over the right medial border scapula, superior aspect of right thoracic area. Let's check your viscera. "Oh boy, does it hurt after you eat?" "Sure does." "Why don't you go in?" "Oh look, you have cholecystitis." Now it's no longer a rib dysfunction. It's now a gallbladder issue, and your gallbladder needs emergency surgery. Good thing we checked that out. So, going in there with a lighter touch, it was once said to me, and I try to tell other people, how hard do you have to push on a pillow to know it's soft? How hard do you have to push on a brick to know it's hard? Go in lighter touch, feel what skin superficial fascia muscle tonus is, and then it helps you get in there and not flare them up on evaluation and actually be able to make very good changes on the first visit versus you flared them up because you were too vigorous.
Wow, that's actually, I've never heard you say that before. I love that. I'm going to use
Yeah,
that.
yeah.
I said the other day to a student in our clinic, I want you to challenge yourself to be as light as you can when you're palpating this or whatever we were looking at and
Sure.
still perceive what is under your hand.
Absolutely.
And that really helped for this particular student. So that was kind of nice to see.
Fantastic. It's getting dark here, so I figured I better turn the lights on. We're out here in Oregon, and it's about 9:05, and it's still light outside, but getting dark where I was speaking to you.
Right. Mike, one other thing that I wanted to ask you, or a couple other things maybe. You've helped a lot of people over the years, whether it's actual patients that come into your clinic, people that you've mentored, students in a con ed class or in Vallejo or other things. If somebody's going to have the blessing to interact with you or learn from you, and if they're only going to remember you, remember something about you, like one or two things from you, what do you hope it would be and why?
Well, I would like to quote Dr. Herman Cabot, who just was so inspirational to me, one with his development of PNF and two with getting a chance to learn from him. And one of the things was, every patient has untapped potential, and it's up to the physical therapist to unlock that potential and to help improve the quality of their life, so that everyone who comes through your door, there's absolutely something that you can do to help them, and to always use their strengths to help their weaknesses, and never to give up or be frustrated if the answer to the problem is not apparent in front of you, but to search until you find it. That's the first thing, is never give up and know there's always something you can do. Because if that patient was able to come through your doors, then that means that there's something you can do to help them. There's only a few type of patients that I've been very saddened I could not have helped. And basically, they had ALS, and they were actually friends of mine. And I was able to help ease the burden temporarily and help with their speech and help their family members get them in a more comfortable position. But unfortunately, based on the disease process, which was terminal, we all know the outcomes with that. So, you know, other than some of those disease processes, always know that there's absolutely something that you can do to help someone else. And you may have to go out there and learn more manual therapy or other skills to have more tools in your toolbox to do that. So if you're dedicated to helping another human being, there's always something you could learn that will help you to help someone else. The other thing is, you know, always remember, enjoy life, treat everybody like you'd like to be treated, and don't take things so seriously that you don't have joy in what you're doing. Just, you know, just always remember, you can always have joy in what you're doing, and everybody has a sense of humor, just be careful you don't cross the line.
Yeah, I've heard a funny story of crossing the line with sense of humor, Mike, about telling a cow joke to a woman who had cows, and it turned out that the certain cow joke actually happened to one of her cows, and she wasn't happy.
Yes, she wasn't. And now every time she comes in, we tell all the new residents about the cow joke, and she repeats the story, and it's pretty funny. And I'll even tell you the cow joke, because it was a Kent Kaiser cow joke. So I said, how bad could this be? I can't offend anybody on this one. And the joke was, what do you call a cow that jumps over a barbed wire fence? And the answer is utter disaster. Yeah. Well, no, I said to this poor lady who was, we were working on her total knee, what do you call a cow that jumps over a barbed wire fence? And she said, the worst day of my life when I was 13 years old and a big vet bill and 130 stitches. And I just became very quiet and said, excuse me. She goes, yep, that's what happened. And yeah. And so you find when you live in a rural community that you got to be careful with cow jokes, because sometimes they're not funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Love those stories. Mike, if you could challenge any of your colleagues or those of us that are younger than you in our professional life, if you could challenge us to something, whether it's in PT or outside of PT, if you could challenge us to do something, to be something, to, you know, anything, what would it be? And why?
What would it be? It would be a person who has joy in all aspects of life. I will tell you a story, and this is why I'll bring this statement up, because I had an attitude adjustment, and this is a very important story that happened to me. Okay. And this is why I tell people, enjoy every minute of your day. And that's my challenge, and this is the story. When I was working at Vallejo, it was about 1992, and I'd been treating spinal cord for quite a while, because I treated spinal cord when I was at Kessler, and I treated spinal cord when I was at Kaiser. So this wasn't my first rodeo. And I had three young men who were all in their wheelchairs together. And one fellow was a C6 quadriplegic, 19 years old. The second, he had been hit by a police car. The second was another 19-year-old who was a victim of gang-related gunshot violence. He was in a movie theater and got shot by a stray bullet. He was about a T8 paraplegic. And the third was also a victim of gang-related violence. He was 21, and his buddy slit his throat, shot him in the neck, left him for dead, took his drugs, took his car. So the kid who they shot and slit his throat was a C4 complete quadriplegic.
Oh, my gosh.
All three are sitting together in a wheelchair in the big gym in Vallejo, and I took the kid who was a C6 quad, 19 years old, And I said to the other two, hey, I'll bring him back in about 45 minutes. You know, we're going to get your therapy going and your other therapists are going to be with you because we all shared patients with our team. And as I'm wheeling this young man out, who's a complete C6 quad, he looks up at me and he goes, hey, I guess I'm pretty lucky, huh? And I said, why do you say that? And he said, man, at least I could move my wrists, my elbows, and my shoulders. That guy can't move anything. At least I'm better off than he is. Wow, he can't even do anything but shrug his shoulders, turn his head. And I said to myself, if a 19-year-old complete C6 quadriplegic is telling me that he's doing well and it could be worse, I have no bad days. A bad day does not exist in my life.
Yeah.
I could have better days and really good days, but I have no bad days because what he taught me is it can always be worse. And when a C6 quad tells you how lucky they are that they're not a C4 quad, you step back and you look at your situation and you give thanks every day that you can wiggle your fingers and toes and that you're in a country like this in the United States of America where you can learn things, not be afraid to express your opinion, and deal with people from all over the world in a relatively safe environment. So,
yeah.
You know, I tell people, please, you know, be happy, give thanks for what you have, you know, count your blessings and enjoy life and enjoy your family and, you know, live every day and enjoy it.
Mike, I don't know if we could end any better than that, but if there's anything else you want to add, I want to give you the chance.
Well, I would like to add that I'm absolutely honored. I'm so honored that you even asked me to do this because I could tell you about 150 therapists that I would put ahead of me for this blog. And that I'm very impressed with your skill level because I've seen you develop over the years and I'm really, really impressed on how you've grown and how you're giving wonderful care to all those people out in Chico, California and with that group with Jeff Zielinski. So I think people are very, very blessed to have you as their therapist as well.
Well, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate that.
All right. Well, good.
Mike, how can any listeners out there, if they want to learn more about you or what you do, how can they learn more about you? Any websites or places that they can go to?
You can call my clinic or email me. Our clinic is Oregon Neurosport Physical Therapy. My email is Mike, M-I-K-E, at Oregon, O-R-E, G-O-N, Euro, E-U-R-O, Sport, S-P-O-R-T, PT.com. You can also Google up the Institute of Physical Art and check out their website and see what classes I'm teaching. Or you can see a goofy picture of me if you go on the University of Oregon website. It's an old one. I have hair. I now no longer have hair. So people will go, oh my gosh, you have hair.
Okay, perfect.
All right.
Well, Mike, hey, thanks a ton, man. It's been great talking to you. Look forward to our next time together.
Perfect. Excellent. And myself as well. And please keep up the good work. And again, it's an honor and a pleasure seeing you.
Thanks, Mike.